This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's radio.
Free
radio.
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream.
Let me clear space for you to sit beside me. You don't need your back against the wall.
I'm Megan Murphy, and you're listening to Feminist Current. 50 years ago, in 1963, Betty Friedan's book, famously addressing the problem that has no name, was published. The feminine mystique was revolutionary and is often credited with sparking the second wave. Friedan interviewed housewives across America who found themselves unfulfilled in the roles they were told would make them the most happy. This problem, that had yet to be named, was affecting many women, but before feminist initiatives like consciousness-raising groups, women felt they were alone in their experiences, and beyond that, that there was something deeply wrong with them as individuals. Were they crazy, depressed, or was it something more? The something more was named and popularized by the feminine mystique. 50 years later, women are free to, supposedly, have it all. Career, family, independence. But Stephanie Kuntz argues women are still getting the short end of the stick as mothers and as part of the workforce. In a recent article published in the New York Times, Kuntz says 50 years after the beginning of the revolution that was meant to provide women with the same opportunities as men, gender equality has hit a wall. Stephanie Kuntz is a professor of family history at Evergreen State College and the author of A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. I spoke with her over the phone from her home in Olympia, Washington. Here is that interview.
So, you know, of course, the feminine mystique was a game changer. Not only at the time it was published, back in the 60s, but it still continues to be relevant and impactful today. So I wonder if you can talk about, first of all, why this book had such a significant impact on the feminist movement to begin with.
Well, I think that The Feminine Mystique was the very first book that popularized a notion that was very radical in the late 50s and early 60s, and that was the idea, as Betty Friedan put it in one of what was a very controversial excerpt from the book in Good Housekeeping magazine, women are people too, with the same aspirations and capabilities as men. And this was just something that wasn't being said in the public press. Actually, the impact of Friedan's book has often been overestimated. You know, there were feminists before her who were already working in government, and there were many feminists who came afterwards. But Friedan came at the perfect moment to sum up a lot of the academic research and the grumbling that had been going on behind the scenes, to put it into print, to explain to people, to many women who were feeling what physicians had already diagnosed as the housewife's syndrome, this sense of depression and boredom and fatigue. And she was able to say in words that women who read women's magazines could understand, this is not your fault. What you have been told is your problem, that you are not sufficiently adjusted to your, quote, feminine destiny, is in fact a problem with our society, that it doesn't recognize your humanity. And so it was very, very important for a whole generation of women, such as my mother, who had been buying into the feminine mystique. And it also, even for people who didn't read it, it gave people a phrase. This was long before anyone had invented the word sexism. So the word, the feminine mystique, was something you could grab onto. You could say, there's something wrong, and oh, maybe it's the feminine mystique. Maybe it's these myths about women.
And of course, one of the issues that was addressed by the feminine mystique, and one of the reasons it was such a revolutionary book, is because it said powerfully, you know, women aren't crazy. So you know, that idea that it doesn't mean there's something wrong with you or that you're losing your mind because you feel unhappy or unfulfilled or frustrated or powerless.
Well, Megan, that is such an important point. You know, I interviewed 200 women and men who'd read it at the time, and that was the most common story I heard. This was the era of Freudianism, reverence for the expertise of psychiatrists. And their idea was that the, as Helene Deutsch put it, one of the first of a long line of women who made a career out of telling other women not to have careers, she said the normal woman renounces all individual aspirations, not out of coercion like in the old days, but because she understands that all of her needs will be met through the achievements of her husband. Mm-hmm. And, you know, women bought into this. They read all these psychological and sociological tracts, and they blame themselves. I talked to one woman who said that, you know, halfway through the book, she got up and flushed her tranquilizers down the toilet because for the first time she realized this is not something wrong with me. This is something wrong with society and the way it treats me.
Amazing. I wonder if you see this kind of individualizing, which is what this is about, really. You know, it's about saying, no, this isn't a systemic issue. This is a problem with you as an individual. You need to deal with this on your own, whether it's through, you know, drugs or whatever. But, I mean, do you see that kind of individualizing happening in terms of women's issues? Do you see that manifesting itself in new places today?
I do see it coming back. I mean, we've come a tremendously long way since the feminine mystique. And, you know, for a lot of young women who read it today, it's like a foreign land, you know, because nobody really longer believes that you're going to get all of your satisfactions from mopping the kitchen floor and following the latest recipe in a woman's magazine. But there are ways in which I think we've seen a resurgence of this idea that it's an individual fault. And in this case, it's a different ideology. Instead of saying, well, women are not capable of this, a normal woman wouldn't want it, now the ideology is, well, we've got all of the equality we need. If there's anything wrong, it's either your fault or it's your partner's fault. And I see that a lot, of blaming either yourself or other women who've made different decisions, or blaming your partner. When you look at, for example, the tremendous stresses that dual earner families are under because of our lack of family-friendly work policies and a sane environment in which to conduct our work, you'll get women and men arguing over who's doing more of the chores, how to divide three full-time jobs between two full-time people is just about impossible. Mm-hmm. And so, once again, it's a good example of what Friedan said very early. She said, you know, sometimes a woman thinks that a new house, a new husband, a new hairdo would solve her problems. But in fact, the problems are much bigger than these individual things. They become of a social injustice. And I think some women have forgotten that today or need to relearn it, let's put it that way.
And, you know, while feminism may have addressed this particular feminine mystique with regards to housewives, you've talked about how now there are new mystiques. So, you know, what are those? What are you seeing?
Well, yes. I mean, I think the old mystique that women are not capable as men is about gone. I've seen studies, for example, of middle schoolers, and the girls no longer feel that they have to play dumb to get a date or that they have to pretend they're not good at sports. Girls today feel comfortable aspiring to almost any of the activities and achievements that used to be associated with men or actually walled off as men only. But there's a new mystique. There are two new mystiques there. One is for the girls themselves. They also feel much more compelled to display that they are sexually available, sexually interested, and hot. I call it the hottie mystique. Mm-hmm. And the flip side of that for the boys is that there is still a very strong masculine mystique, so that even though it's okay for girls to do what used to be called men things, it's still not okay for guys to like what used to be thought of as female activities and interests. They get bullied and teased, often physically bullied, and although it's usually enforced by other boys, often the girls do go along with it. So there are two mystiques there. And then at a slightly later age, I think for a woman, there was a new mystique, and it's no longer the housewife mystique, but it's the motherhood mystique. This idea that somehow you have to be totally available to enrich your child's life every moment of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And women start to feel very guilty about that and to internalize it. And it's so ironic and sad because actually working mothers actually spend as much time interacting with their kids and enriching their lives as stay-at-home mothers did in the 1960s.
And, you know, I wanted to talk about this, the article that you wrote in the New York Times recently, because in it you say something interesting. You say that gender equality has hit a wall. So I wonder what you mean by that. I mean, why has gender equality stalled, as you put it?
Well, there are some areas, of course, in which we do continue to progress, but I think the biggest wall that we've hit is precisely this one I mentioned a few minutes ago, and that is the work-family dilemmas that we have.
Yeah.
We live in a country that has done absolutely made no progress at all in adjusting the workforce to modern family arrangements since 20 years, 1993, when we passed the Family Medical Leave Act. Now, at the time, the Family Medical Leave Act looked like, oh, goodness, this is going somewhere. Only about half of all workers were covered, because if you work in a company that employs less than 50, you're not, you don't get it. But it did give 12 weeks of unpaid leave for family leave. Well, that seemed nice, except that since then, all of our European allies, and in fact, every place in the world except a few places like Papua New Guinea, have instituted paid maternity leaves and longer maternity leaves than we have that cover more people than we do. 81 of them have instituted leaves for fathers as well. While the rest of the world has been progressing in terms of adjusting to the reality of dual earner families and single parent families, the United States has stood still for 20 years. And in fact, we've slipped back. You know, in 1971, the Senate passed a comprehensive child care bill, and it was vetoed by President Nixon at the time. Since then, we've never come even near doing that kind of reform, even though 70% of American kids grow up in families where every adult in the household is in the labor force.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wonder, what else do you think, in terms of legislation and in terms of changes to the law, what do you think needs to be done now in order to move forward? I mean, aside from you've mentioned some very important things, but, you know, what else?
Well, we need to have paid, subsidized maternity leave so that it doesn't become a class privilege to stay home with your kids.
Mm-hmm.
We also should do what Sweden and several other countries are experimenting with, and that is to also have paternal leave that is not changeable with the female leave, so that each partner has the incentive to take it or else it will be lost, because that really helps men bond with their kids and stops us from perpetuating their second-class status as parents.
Mm-hmm.
We need child care, and President Obama's proposal for universal preschool is very welcome, and I hope that can get through. We should also consider limits on work hours. You know, there's not enough work to go around in America, but some people have way too much work. And unlike most countries in the world, we have no statutory limit on the work week. We also have very, very regressive penalties for people who go to part-time work, partly because we don't have universal health insurance, so you lose your health benefits if you drop down to part-time work, but also because, unlike Europe, we don't require employers to pay people who do the same work part-time the same price per hour as the full-timers get. Often, if you're a lawyer, for example, you'll often take a 40 to 50% pay cut if you drop down to part-time work, even though you're doing the same amount of work per hour.
Hmm.
So I think it's very important to reform that, to give people more options.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to talk with you about it.
You just heard an interview with writer and professor of family history at Evergreen State College, Stephanie Kuntz. For more on her work, visit stephaniekuntz.com. Her article, published in the New York Times on February 16th, is called Why Gender Equality Stalled. I'm Megan Murphy, and that is all the time we have for today. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current.
I am woman, hear me roar, in numbers too big to ignore, and I know too much to go back and pretend, 'cause I've heard it all before, and I've been down there on the floor, no one's ever gonna keep me down again. Oh, yes, I'm wise, but it's wisdom for the pain. Yes, I paid the price, but look how much I gained. If I have to, I can do anything. I am strong,
strong.
I am invincible,
invincible.
I am woman. You can bend but never break me, 'cause it only serves to make me more determined to achieve my final goal. And I come back even stronger, not a novice any longer, 'cause you deepen the conviction in my soul. Oh, yes, I'm wise, but it's wisdom for the pain. Yes, I pay the price, but look how much I gained. If I have to, I can do anything. I am strong,
strong.
I am invincible.
Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.